You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Amato Al-Fadni. He's talking to me from Cairo. Amato, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you so much.
Amato, I want to talk about your work, of course, and get into the Black Ivory Project, but I also want to ask you a little bit about Cairo, and you're Egyptian-born Sudanese artist. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct, and I think that's part of the influence I had in my career as a visual artist as well.
And what is, how is Cairo for artists? It seems that you've exhibited a lot there. It seems very active. Is Cairo very supportive of artists?
I don't think in the last, it was, but in the last maybe couple of years, it changed a lot because of the political situation that we have here. But I can say that between, like, especially like between 2011, just after the revolution, until like 2013, it was much active and much bigger, if you say that word. Like, it was easier for artists to, like, exhibit his work without getting permissions from security.
Mm. And now you have to ask permission to exhibit work?
Yeah, sure, I have to ask permission. I have to be very careful, and the gallery is also, like, have to be very careful. Like, I had a show, like, it was 3 months ago, I guess, yeah. It was called Mahongo, and I had to rewrite, like, my statement, like, 3 times, just in case that anything in the statement could be, like, causing any kind of trouble.
So let's talk about that a little bit, because it's not that you're trying to stay away from trouble. You're talking about some pretty serious issues, and they're often political. Isn't that the case? And we should talk about Black Ivory, which I know is ongoing. Was that the show that you had to present and rewrite your statement for?
I did that already also in the Black Ivory and the Mahongo, the latest one. But also, especially because Black Ivory, I'm talking about, like, the Sudan slavery in Egypt, or in the Middle East in general. Yeah, it's been, like, I'm not going to say my passion, but it's been, like, something that I've been really trying to work on since I started doing art. And until, like, a couple of years ago, that was doing my researches, and I was working on a certain troop, like, they were Sudanese, and they were fighting in Mexico.
But let's talk about exactly how that started, because I want to hear about how Black Ivory developed over the course of your career so far. How did Black Ivory begin, and can you describe the beginnings?
I guess the beginning started from my mid school, if I can say that. You introduced me, like, I'm Sudanese born, and I'm Sudanese. I was born in Cairo. I was raised here, and I was in Egyptian public school. And part of my curriculum in school was about, like, Muhammad Ali, like, the founder of modern Egypt. And there's a chapter also, especially the chapter in history, like, it says here that Muhammad Ali, he tried to form an army from the Sudanese, but it didn't work out. And there's a question mark. And the way I was taught in school, that my history teacher was saying that in class, and he said, like, it didn't work out because Sudanese are too lazy. That's why they failed. And I was super offended by that time. I was like 12. I was like, okay, no, I'm not, that's not my people. Like, you know, this is something wrong with this statement, you know. And then I was thinking of history, like, what's real there, what's not real, and I was doubting history, you know. And when I started to work on that project, I started to read more about, especially this era, like in the, actually it's like in the end of 19th century. Like, the official story says, like, he tried to build an army, and that's why he, like, colonized Sudan. So he took, like, 500,000 Sudanese children, I mean, because they were between age, like, 7 and 15, like, to Egypt through the desert. And out of the 500,000, only like maybe 30,000 made it to Egypt. So he tried it also, like, to, he was too, there was no time for him to, like, find another way, which could be the Red Sea. So he should build a harbor in Sudan, which is going to take some time. So he formed his army from the Egyptians.
So the reason he couldn't form an army from the Sudanese is because he killed them all with a travel to Egypt.
Yeah, exactly. And nobody talks about it, neither in Sudan nor in Egypt, because the also in Sudanese part, like our politicians since the or who found the independence of Sudan, they were also involved in the slavery. So you find that, like, even in Sudan, we don't talk about that much, you know. So it was for me like an issue, like, you know, I have always to defend myself. Like, when every day I speak to somebody about Sudan, I have to tell how the being black doesn't mean like I cannot do anything or I'm lazy, you know. It's like it's some things happened before in the history and you don't know about it. So I was trying to find a way to talk about that.
And I want to hear more, but the reason you defend yourself every day or often is that because that idea persists, that Egyptians still think that the Sudanese are lazy or have other stereotypes because of that whole massacre?
Yeah, I mean, that massacre actually is not exist in the textbook. Like, you don't read about it. So what you read, that the question mark, it didn't happen. And of course, why that you go to the stereotype, okay, you should be because, you know, whatever negative thing that you can talk about me or about Sudanese in general. So it was like a problem for me all the time. Yeah.
And so when did the first show of Black Ivory come about, and what was shown there? And let's talk about how it reflected this question that it sounds like you keep investigating.
I did research because I start like archival art with the show before the Black Holocaust Museum, and then I start to continue work on this thing. So I was reading about that special troupe. Like, the story goes, like, the French asked the Egyptian, the French emperor asked the Egyptians, like, to send him, like, black soldiers, because he was losing the war in Mexico, and then they thought, like, because the French, the Europeans, they cannot really fight in this hot weather, so the African will do the job. So he asked the Egyptian Khedive to send him, like, a gift, if you can say the word. And Khedive of Egypt, like, he took like 500 from Sudan and hardly trained them and then shipped them to Mexico. So I'm talking about the story of like one of the of this troop who just been taken from the villages, and one day they were on a different continent, different, like fighting for the French against the Native Americans or the Mexican there. So it's for me, it's like surreal somehow. So
I'm sorry to interrupt, but is that the Black Holocaust you referred to before? Because I know that's another project of yours.
That's another project. No. That's the Black Ivory.
Okay. So we'll get to that. But go on. Yeah, that is a very bizarre situation. So right there.
Yeah, it was a bizarre situation. It was really strange. Oh yeah. So. Yeah, and they were in Mexico, and some of them that returned, like, I mean, I guess 315 made it back after the war was over. And then they were sold again to the British Army. So one day they were French soldiers, and the next morning they are British soldiers. And then they had to fight in Sudan. So, sorry. I had this research, and I was doubting my resources. Like, I was still like reading, like, you know, like Egyptian and British sources, which are the colonialists, you know. So I just don't feel like I should really trust that, or at least I should not like represent it, you know. So what I was trying to do, I was going through the names of these soldiers and try to follow them, like. And I was doing that online because I couldn't have access to like libraries in general. So like I was trying to find something here or there, and then I found a Sudanese journalist. Like he translated like our interview with one of the soldiers of them, and I had an interview for him, and I read it, and the guy whose name was Ali Jifoun, and his story. I read about him in one of the books, is about the Egyptian Sudanese troop in Mexico by Prince Omar Tosun. It was that book was published in 1936. So I start to read about how he sees, how he experienced the Egyptian army from his own perspective as a slave in the army. I took his story and with my research about the trip, you know, so I did like he's telling his own story, like his memoir, through like five sculptures of ivory, and they were painted black. And the concept of the name came from the black ivory, actually came from the British, because that's what they used to call it to write, when they were writing the telegrams in Sudan, they were asking for black ivory, which means he like slaves to fight in the armies.
Which means specifically Sudanese slaves.
Sudanese slaves, yeah. And another thing in history, like, because when the British came to colonize Sudan, they came under the slogan that the ending slavery, and that's what Jordan Basha tried to do in Sudan, which is real at some point, because he actually they tried to end the domestic slavery, but they started a new form of slavery, a different form, like which is called the military slavery, and they started to like have the Nubian soldiers to fight for them in the colonies in the colonies in Africa or even in Asia, like in India and Indonesia, and Myanmar as well. So here's history. It's been just made up in the way that the person who was writing it, just he can benefit from it. And that person that I'm talking about, Ali Jifoun, actually he was one of the soldiers in some of the wicked troop, like when he invaded Sudan to end up slavery. And the way he was talking about it, like when he was fighting with the British to free the Sudanese, he was saying that they were like going to villages, taking men to be soldiers and selling women in the market. So actually they were doing the same thing. So I took his memoir and then like I start to like rewriting it, and I start my first phase, like his journey from being kidnapped from his hometown or his village in Sudan, in South Sudan, up to he made it to the 40 days road, which actually like it's 40 days walking from Darfur in West Sudan to Asyut. And that was actually slave roads for like last 2,000 years. And then he's up to, he got to Alexandria, and that was the black ivory. And then my next project I'm working on right now is like to follow the journey in Mexico.
So let's talk about that project. How is it visualized? I know it's been sculptural and there's been audio installations in Cairo of this. What is the next project about black ivory going to look like? How will it be made?
I'm not sure yet, because actually it's somehow abstract to me. Like when I did like the audio for that project, telling the story, I had a big problem, like which language should I use, you know? Is it Arabic or English? Because both they're not his native language, and also like it's presenting the colonial thing. So I tried to find somebody who speaks the native language, which was Sholuk. And because this language is oral language, so I found like a priest here in Cairo from that tribe, from his specific tribe, and he read the story by the native language. So here, like, for the next step, I'm still willing to work on this method, like, oral history and which way I'm going to present it, in which media. Like, you know, it should be a text, because texting here, like, I'm not, like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not really trying to take it from its source and then represent it in a different way, or in the way that, like, it's not native to the person or to the topic that I'm trying to talk about here.
Right. And so let's talk about one of the installations that were already done, just so, I mean, there'll be images in this interview too, but just so listeners can understand how you brought together the sculpture and audio installation, perhaps the last iteration of Black Ivory.
Sorry, again?
Yeah, what did the last installation of Black Ivory look like? There was, I mean, it could be one from 2016 or recently, but number one, Black Ivory was an installation that that was one of the first on this project?
Yeah.
And what did that look like? Yeah, how did that come together? Because there was audio and sculpture there.
Yeah. So I tried to present, like, the five horns into like a shape of a map, so like a point. So actually you go in the room and you find the text or the scripts in English and Arabic in the end of the room. So you have to go through the ivory, which, like, I guess it was like 3 meters high. And actually while you're walking through them, the audio comes within from the inside, from, like, they are inside the in the horns. So actually you can hear them, like, you can hear it, and it actually it's like, so each horn, like, tells part of the story. So actually while you're walking and you're hearing that the man speaking about himself, about his journey in his native language.
And the, and these horns, you refer to them as horns, they look
the ivory.
Yeah, the ivory, it's made out of, I don't know what it's made out of, but they look like huge elephant horns, like ivory, right?
Yeah. Like, I did the research. I took, like, the right size, and I was doing research about, like, the African elephants, and especially the elephants living in the region, and how big, and, you know, like, so it took some time also to, like an actual size and shaped, like a horn shape, yeah.
Hmm. And how is that received? So this is a conversation when it's like, and I love that, it's like the ivory is talking to you, those horns are talking to you, and they're telling the oral history of really what that means, that term Black Ivory, of course. How did that show go? Did people talk to you about it? Was it controversial? I would imagine it would be.
It was a bit controversial for sure, because, like, even the talk that I have afterwards were like, I had always this tension because I tried to bring it, you know, because, I mean, for here, like, when the Egyptians came to Sudan, they did, like, a good thing there, like, they built the country as, like, no, you're just colonizing a country. And also, like, bringing the religion, because actually, like, that's what I'm talking about, actually, okay, so the first official, like, slave documents in Sudan, it was called Bakht, and it was like in the 7th century, and it was between the Muslims and the Sudanese, or the Nubian at that time, because when the Arabs came to Egypt, if you can say that, like, they tried to go south to the Nubian border, and we were Christian by that time, so we, like, it was impossible for them to cross, so they had this agreement, and in that agreement it says, like, to for the Arabs and the Egyptians to keep the Nubians safe, or to have a peace with them, that each year that the Nubians have to give, like, 400 slaves to the Arabs or to the Egyptians. And that was going on for, like, almost, like, 4 centuries, until, like, the Nubians converted to Islam. And even, like, Ibn Khaldun, even, like, Arabic writers, like, or at that time, like, Ibn Khaldun, he said that, like, the Sudanese converted to the religion not because they loved it, but because they were too sick giving away their children to the Arabs. Mm. And that's actually in the textbook that in Egypt is being sold in Egypt. Like, it's not like something like, it's not there, you know, or, you know. But the problem here is, like, and what I'm trying to talk about is, like, the, I don't have to call it in English, but I'm just calling it, like, unspoken history. because the history exists and it's there, it's somewhere in the library, but no one wants to talk about it, you know. So what I'm trying to do is just like to bring this information out. And of course, like, the receiving of this show, it was not that people didn't really like accept it in the beginning, maybe still now a little bit talk about it, but still in general not wasn't that easy to be received.
Of course, it's fascinating and great work that this Black Ivory project will continue, and you'll continue to do more shows in Cairo or also other places in the world. What's the future of it?
Now, the future is now, like, I'm working on writing with two friends to do like a graphic novel about another story, because what I've been doing this research, like, I've been going on another, find new things that another new dimensions to talk about. So now I'm collecting stories of some of these ex-slaves, like Jimmy Durham and Felix Darfour, like, who was in Haiti, and Jimmy, who was like in Ireland. So I'm trying to rewriting it, but like presented. It was never presented before, so I'm trying to present that, because actually it's still like, I mean, the issue I'm talking about, like, also it's not just like history happened before, it's happening today, like part of it also, like, the Nubians in Kenya, because the Nubians or the Sudanese, like, slaves or slaves, they were the families are still there until today. They don't have rights or don't have citizenships until today. So actually, it's going on crisis, if I can say that. And I saw that also, like, from the citizens community here, because there's some also like segregation from the students who are in Egyptian army, that we can put in quotation slaves. They are here as well, like I am, and we all have no rights in this country. We all don't have citizenship. We cannot have any access to anything here. So we're still being treated as aliens here. Like, you know, like, we are not part of the community here. We're not belonging here, and we just have this kind of image about us.
Right, and and what will happen? So as this grows, this project grows, it seems that the conversation will continue to grow. And it's so political. I would imagine, as you said at the beginning of this interview, that it becomes difficult to stage these shows in Cairo, or isn't it?
Oh yeah, of course, in Cairo, even in Sudan, it's impossible to, yeah.
So let me talk just a step back a little bit. Before I ask you the last question, you've traveled a lot, done a lot of residencies in different parts of the world. Your work itself doesn't seem to be easily in the marketplace. How is it funded? How do you fund your installations, your stories, your traveling? There's a lot of expenses that go into it. Can I ask how that's funded?
For the Black Ivory and the Black Holocaust Museum, I was invited by a gallery to do these two projects, and then they had the fund for the project, so it was great for me as well. And for the traveling also, like, I always look for international funding, and I apply as Egyptian artist, because, which is funny, like, Sudan is not really in the funding map, because it's not considered like African country, and it's not also Middle Eastern country, you know. So, like, you know, I always apply like Middle Eastern Egyptian artist.
Right. So it's kind of in between. So there's grants you get for that? Is that what happens? I mean, the gallery supported it. I would imagine the gallery's hoping for sales, right? That's the idea there. Is that also how it's supported? Is sales of the work, or is there grants and other?
No, it's a grant for the book. No, they get grants for the project, and then like I can go with it. Yeah. So sometimes it happens with the gallery or myself. It depends on the project, so I have to do, you know, see how it works in each case separately.
Right. And so it seems like, I mean, I ask these questions because in the United States there's very little support for the arts, or it seems not as much as in a lot of the rest of the world. So it sounds like your work, though controversial in Cairo, is able to be supported through public funds or private funds through foundations. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, through like private funds and foundation, yeah, and maybe international funding as well, yeah.
It's wonderful talking to you about this. A very, very important project and really a message, I think, that you're delivering to people, a kind of, as you said, almost a hidden history. Is there anything you want to say before I ask you the last question about what you're reading? Is there anything I should have asked or you want to add to this conversation?
Yeah, I would like to add something else. Like, one of the reasons, like, I've been working on this topic for some time, and it's really controversial, and it's not easy, and it's super hard to present, and of course, like, it's consuming, like, financially, everything. And I guess one of the reasons, like, I've been told by a person that I met in, in Athens, that was telling me that, like, it has to do with my personal trauma. And I found out, like, I'm not doing that because, not just because it's an important topic, but it because it has some influence on my personality as well. And it becomes because actually my family, like my mother, from my mother's side, were involved in this trade as well. So I feel kind of like I'm connected to the topic because actually there's something that I've been hiding for a long time, not telling anybody or keep it as a secret. But I feel like it's kind of my duty as well to bring it up.
And let me ask you the last question now. What are you reading at the moment? A little off topic, but I'm always curious what people are reading.
I'm reading like a novel now. It's somehow also connected to my research at some point by Hamur Ziyada, Ishaq al-Darvish. And he's talking about the Mahdist revolution in Sudan in the 19th century through one of the slaves who were there in Sudan.
Amado, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.